Let me hasten to invite Bucks Wessels from the University of Free State, South Africa, to make his presentation on the future of the US dollar as an international key currency, one of the issues which have actually unfolded since this disaster which I've referred to, the international financial crisis. Buck Wessels.
Thank you, Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for attending. We're a little bit pushed for time. I've got plenty of slides, so I'll have to skip some of them due to the time constraint, so please bear with me. I'm going to start straight away, and this is the scope of the paper. I can't deal with everything now. We've been cut back from 15 minutes to 12. Right, so this is more or less the scope. I'm going to focus mainly on the last two. The last two is the worrying trends in the dollar and the conclusion. So I'm going to skip many of the others. This slide shows you all the international money, every bit of international liquidity that there is. It contains gold, special drawing rights, positions at the IMF, and of course, foreign currencies. Let's go short. What I can say is that looking at this very busy table, we can summarize by saying that special drawing rights at the IMF is negligible. Gold has been demonetized, it's also negligible, you can actually cut it out. What remains is that global currencies selected by international markets, like the dollar, like the pound, like the euro, like the yen, they dominate the whole scene. And those positions look like this. Of all the currencies, and remember, all the currencies form 98% of the total amount of international money. And here we have the dollar dominating with the 64% in currency positions, with the euro tracking behind at 27%. The other currencies like the yen and the British pound and the Swiss franc and whatever other currency you can think of, they form only a very minor part of all of them. Here you can clearly see how the dollar dominate from 1998 up to 2008. The dollar is in position, it's reigning, it's supreme, a slight decrease since 2001. But on the opposite side, you can also see that the euro didn't make much leeway, didn't make much headway. Everybody expected the euro to be a keen rival to the dollar and to actually replace the dollar at some time. Well, it didn't, and it will not. So these are the slides I'm going to skip. These slides tell you, this one I've got to show you. This slide tells us what happens on the daily turnover on the foreign exchange markets of the world. Every day, trillions of dollars get exchanged on foreign exchange markets around the globe. And here, the dollar also dominates. The dollar has got 86%. Of course, that is out of 200% because each currency is on both sides of the equation. So the dollar has got 86% out of 200%. The euro tracks far behind with 37% out of 200. And then you can see that the yen and the pound sterling, Swiss franc, Australian dollar, well, we need not spend any time on them. The two dominating ones are the dollar and the euro. So this far we can say that the dollar reigns supreme. To add to all the former statistics, 59% of all cross-border deposits around the globe consist of dollars. 46% of all outstanding foreign debt in the world consists of dollar-denominated securities. 65% of all banknotes that are held overseas, not domestically, but overseas, 65% are in dollars, not euros. 52% of all cross-border bank loans around the globe consist of dollar-denominated bank loans. There are 60 countries that peg to the dollar. There are 40 euro pegs. So, yes, we can go on and on and on and on. The main scene, the main conclusion is that, yes, the dollar dominates. But how does a money become a key currency? If you dominate the world, you have the key currency of the world. Well, there are four or five determinants. They determine whether you should be in the first or second or third position. Once again, I cannot dwell on them. I would have loved to do so because these are the ones that actually supported the dollar in becoming the main key currency. The five determinants are all in favor of the United States. Here is the inflation. The United States inflation is not always the lowest, but it's stable. You must have a dominant economy. Here, let me skip this and bring you to the table. World GDP, the United States have got about 20% of world GDP. This table comes from the IMF. The tables, or most of the tables, come either from the IMF or the BIS. In my paper, you'll see the sources below the tables. Once again, you can see that the GDP of the United States, 20% of the world total, dominates all the others. Euro area, all the countries inside the euro area, has got 15%. Right at the bottom, you'll see China rising very fast. 20 years ago, China had 2%, 12.52 currently. It is projected that China will be the biggest economy in the world by 2022 or 2025. It will possibly overtake the United States. But currently, the United States is still the biggest. Okay, there are many other determinants that will determine whether your currency will become the key one and the key currency or not. Unfortunately, I cannot deal with them. They are actually very interesting. The other thing I want to say, having covered very fast the determinants, is that if you are the key currency of the world, you can derive many privileges, extraordinary, actually exorbitant privileges, and it rakes home and it brings home many benefits to the country. These are some of them. Once again, I cannot dwell on them, but I would like to dwell on some of these. Some of the benefits that the U.S. derives from having the world's key currency is that it can obtain a higher growth, it can manage and run bigger current account deficits, it's got higher living standards. Look at bullet number two. United States citizens, United States overall, is allowed to live 20% above its means just by being the key currency of the world, just deriving the benefits and the privileges of running bigger current account deficits, bigger, higher growth. It can actually live 20% higher above its means. Yes, and it free rides. The U.S. free rides on all the other countries because they've got to hold dollars. They've got to hold everything they have in United States dollars. And that constitute a major privilege. Right. But there are some threats. There are some red alerts. There are some red lights flickering. And I'm going to focus only on three. They are indicated in red. Current account deficits, enormous increases in the U.S. budget deficit, and the sharp decline in the United States net international investment position. Right. Here's the first one of the red alerts. The current account balance of the United States. At one stage, 2006, 2007, it reached minus seven. The deficit was minus seven. That's enormous. That's scary. Look at the current account deficits of all the other countries. You will see that nowhere close are the other countries running such deficits. And here is the balance on current account. And you can see how it dropped. Currently, because of the recession, the big recession, it has recuperated a little bit. But after the recession, this might as well go down again, and the huge trade account deficit might reappear, very likely. Debt. The United States is the biggest debtor nation. It is a debt-enslaved nation because the 83% that you see here has now risen to almost 100% in 2010. So debt, United States external debt as a percentage of GDP of the United States has reached 100%. Of course, Japan is in much bigger problems, but it's not a key currency country. So yes, the United States is pretty much over-indebted, and this is the next worrying trend, the U.S. deficit. United States budget deficit has reached minus 10, moving towards minus 11. That's huge. The IMF says minus 3 is okay. Minus 6 is bad. UK and United States has got minus 10 and minus 11%. Future generations not yet born are going to pay down this debt. And it's going to take a long time before you can. This is the third worrying trend that I've mentioned, the net international investment position of the United States. This graph tells you that foreigners hold more assets in investments in the United States than the United States keep and hold in their countries. So the net international investment position is strongly against the United States. That means that at some other time, paying down those debts and the interest and the dividends will be almost unsustainable because where is the United States going to get the money from? Right. So let me rush to the conclusions. After 60 years of supremacy, the dollar is now threatened because of those three ratios that I've mentioned. If the distrust in the dollar gets so big that there's a flight out of the dollar, it's will cause a huge depreciation, high interest rates, high inflation rates, and it will cause a world recession. Remember, the United States is the locomotive, it's the economic locomotive of the world. The world needs, especially China, need the United States as an economic locomotive to pull the whole global train. If people should lose trust in the United States dollar, flee from the dollar, and the dollar depreciates and people pull out, it will cause a world recession very much bigger than the big recession that we had in 1929, 1933. It will also mean a decline in United States political power, a decline in United States economic power. Asia will rise to prominence, and there will be a power shift from the West to the East. It's happening in any way. And big question is this going to be a hard landing, or is it going to be a soft landing? Well, let's hope it's a soft one. And that will only be possible if countries of the world come together, sit around the table, and it should be a round table with everyone having a voice, not according to your political and economic influence. Everybody's got to have an equal say. If they can do that, then we will probably be able to hammer out a new dispensation. But it's going to take long. The current international monetary structure is not favorable to any such thing, so it's going to take a long time. Yet, the United States dollar will survive. Despite all the problems, despite all the red alerts, it's going to survive because, for one thing, bullet number three, there's no serious contender. The dollar hasn't really got a rival. The euro is crumbling. The British pound is days gone. And the Swiss franc and the Japanese yen, there's simply no replacement currency for the dollar. And because all the paper monies have got problems nowadays, that's why everybody's fleeing to gold. If you watch the gold price has gone up 50%. So yes, nobody trusts paper money, they flee into gold. But yet, if you need paper, the dollar is the one to go. There's no serious contender for the dollar. To take the SDR as a synthetic currency and make something out of that is not going to succeed, not in the next 10 years. So the United States, it still has enormous strategic, diplomatic, and military power, unrivaled. And United States will surely defend the current status of the dollar, the status quo of the dollar, because of all the benefits that it rake in, because of all the privileges that it bring to the United States. It will heavily defend the status quo, and that means that the dollar will survive into the future. Currently, there's also no other safe haven to flee to. When there's a problem, when there's international crisis, everyone pour the money into the New York money markets. And that means that it's the only safe haven to take your money with. So this is my final conclusion. We live in an unhealthy world. The position of the dollar is threatened, but there's no replacement, and the displacement is not going to take is going to take a long time. So we'll have to bear with it. And currently there's no other country that can provide the umbrella that the United States provide. So that's a position of disequilibrium. But for us, luckily, it's a stable disequilibrium. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's all I have to say. Alarm said we must take all the questions at the end. Bunch them back.
Okay. So I know there were questions from the floor, but note them. We'll take them at the end, just to ensure that at least we go through all of the presentations. Thank you very much, Wells. Okay, we move on to the second presentation very quickly, and it is the impact of the financial crisis on investors in countries governed by Islamic banking and finance. The case of Dubai, the world stands still. And that will be done by
Michael Busler. Thank you. Let me push the right buttons here. Let's get that a little bigger.
Okay, what I did with my paper, I wanted to take a look at this financial crisis that we're in. What really caused this financial crisis? And there has been a lot of research done with a number of different views, and I'm going to come up with mine. And then secondly, the Western world seemed to be hit pretty hard by this, but the countries that follow Islamic banking didn't seem to be hit hard at all, and I was trying to figure out why that was. And I admit I don't know anything, or didn't when I started, about Islamic banking, other than they're not supposed to charge interest on debt. I think the real cause of the financial crisis, in the early 1990s, sociologists convinced U.S. government leaders that many of the social problems we have, high crime rates, et cetera, would be minimized if people own their own homes rather than rent. Historically, about 60 to 62% of the American population owned homes, the remainder rented. Congress in 1994 said they wanted to change that and bring that total up to 70%. The way the mortgage banking system works in the U.S., a bank will originate a mortgage. When they get about 10 of them, they package them and they sell them to a secondary mortgage holder. Over half of them go to two quasi-government agencies known as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Both of those agencies said to banks that they want to see mortgages that are given to areas and given to people who historically would not qualify for mortgages. So the banking industry went ahead and did that. And then they packaged them, sold them to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had over $1 trillion worth of these. They went to Lehman Brothers and told them to package them to sell on the open market. These became known as mortgage-backed securities. Mortgage-backed securities were not necessarily profitable when they were issued because the interest rates were relatively low, but they would derive value once the interest rates adjusted upward, hence the term derivatives. We call these subprime mortgages, which accounted historically for less than 10% of the total market, and by 2008, they were up to about 20% of the total market. Now, basically, how does it work? In a conventional situation, just to pick some round numbers, if somebody bought a house for $100,000, he typically put 20% down payment, take out a mortgage for the other $80,000, and typically about a 6% interest rate. The people that were not homeowners, but rather renters, couldn't afford this. So through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they said to the mortgage originators, well, why can't they afford it? And the answer was, they don't have 20% to put down. Well, let's have a mortgage where they can put as little as 3% down. There was even one program where we didn't have to put anything down. The other thing was they couldn't afford the monthly payments at a 6% rate. So they said, let's give them an adjustable rate, 3% for the first 2 or 3 years. After that, the rate will adjust upward. So we got a large number of people taking out what we call these subprime mortgages. All this seemed to make sense as long as housing prices continued to go up, which they did through the 90s and the early 2000s and peaked in 2006. Now, since then, home values have dropped in the U.S. on average about 20%. And the thing that really made this a problem was when these adjustable rate mortgages adjusted upward, the people living in the homes couldn't afford the payments. What happens in the U.S. When that occurs, the bank forecloses on the house, and essentially the owners of the house just walked away. They had little or no cash into it. There were no real ramifications for walking away. If there was a $97,000 mortgage on the house was only worth $80,000. They walked away. The mortgage holder then had to take that loss. What that meant was that the mortgage-backed securities really lost most of their value, and as a result of that, we ended up with a financial collapse. Now, that didn't happen in the Islamic banking world, and why not? Well, most of the Middle Eastern countries Their revenue is generated from oil, which was about $50 a barrel in 2007, got up to almost $150 a barrel by mid-2008, and then dropped down to about $37 a barrel by the end of 2008, causing a lot of financial problems there. The one I looked at was Nakheel, who's part of the Dubai world. They had taken out $5.2 billion worth of what are called sukuks, the equivalent of a bond. But instead of paying interest, the sukuks paid a portion of the profit, and then periodically principal payments were made. And there didn't seem to be a problem with that. If profits were a little bit low, the borrower would take out a loan from the lender to cover the profit, and then sometime in the future pay that back. If profits were a little high, the lender didn't take any more of that. So it's certainly different than a conventional bond. The other thing is the borrower guarantees the principal. So that if there is and there can't be a default, but if there is what they call a standstill, if there is something like that occurs, the borrower guarantees that the lender will recover in full. So as a result of that, there were no real defaults on mortgages since you couldn't default on these sukuks. However, Dubai World, Nakheel, part of Dubai World, had to make a periodic principal payment, which it could not make. Now, in the U.S., that would be a default. You had a payment that you couldn't make. In Islamic banking, they used the term a standstill. It wasn't a default. They called it a standstill, and they gave some time for Dubai World to work this out, which eventually they did, and they're continuing there. It is somewhat of a problem in the U.S. also. In 2006, East Cameron Partners in Louisiana, in U.S., used sukuks to finance some of their real estate development activities. The company ended up going bankrupt in 2008, and the case is now in front of a bankruptcy judge in Louisiana. The debate centers on whether a sukuk should be treated as a debt instrument or as an equity instrument. And that's very critical because in bankruptcy, the debtors are paid first, and then if there's anything left over, the equity interests get something. Usually in bankruptcy, there's barely enough to cover the debtors, so the equity holders wouldn't get anything. So the question is, are these sukuks really debt or equity? The U.S. courts, at least the bankruptcy courts, are looking at this, and it has yet to be resolved. Okay, I have to do this in 12 minutes, so am I okay with my time? Okay, so my conclusion would be that the financial crisis was really brought about by the U.S. government interfering in the marketplace, something the U.S. government has seemed to done extensively in the last 2 years, although that seems to be somewhat changing now. The way they got involved in this market was they wanted to increase home ownership for people who really couldn't afford to pay mortgages. They made the mortgages attractive so they could initially buy the home. Then after things adjusted, they defaulted on the mortgages. That led to the collapse in the housing industry. That led to the collapse of these mortgage-backed securities, which I believe really triggered this financial crisis. Additionally to that, or adding to that, it made the U.S. housing market look very poor because suddenly all these homes that have been foreclosed on, they're now owned by the banks. The banks put them on the market, and they just want to sell at whatever price they can get out. It's very difficult for a bank to hold those kind of assets on their balance sheet, so they're selling them at significantly reduced prices, which has had a negative impact on everybody else's equity. As a result of that collapse in the housing market, the mortgage-backed securities lost value. These are derivative instruments, which again means they derive value based on something happening. The something happening was the interest rates would adjust upward, they would have more payments being made to them, and these mortgage-backed securities would then be would have more value. Of course, that never happened. The market collapsed, and all these mortgage-backed securities suddenly didn't have any value at all. In the Islamic banking world, there was no financial meltdown, I believe, primarily because they don't charge interest, although they do charge fees for making the loan. But the key difference is, I believe, that borrowers in the mortgage, in the Islamic banking system, are required to repay and will repay 100% of principal. In the U.S. system, and I think in most of the Western world, if a homeowner walks away from a home, the bank gets it. If they come up short, they just end up losing money. The homeowner then is not liable for that. Similar to conventional bonds, if bonds are used to finance some activity, the activity goes under, the bondholders recover the asset. Typically, they don't have enough value in the asset to cover the debt, and they simply have to take a loss. Again, that wouldn't happen with Islamic banking. So on the good side, Islamic banking does protect investors against at least losing principal. Now, on the negative side, it puts all of the risk onto the borrower, who oftentimes is an entrepreneur. And if that's the case, by having added risk, projects have to be more profitable before they'll be undertaken to compensate for that higher risk. It may be that the U.S. and Western countries have developed more rapidly because of that feature. And entrepreneurs, perhaps in countries that practice Islamic banking, are a little bit more reluctant to take on risky projects because they know they become personally liable for all of the principal. Admittedly, this is the first time I looked at this. When I researched the literature, there really wasn't anything else I could find there. So admittedly, more research on this is needed.
Thank you. That's 12 minutes.
All right, thank you very much, Michael. The next presentation, the role of Oman Development Bank in financing small and medium scale industries, and will be done by, and I'll say for short, Hema. So, forgive me, I won't try the name, please.
Hello. My topic is here, the role of Oman Development Bank in financing small and medium-scale enterprises in Sultanate of Oman. Sultanate is one of the GCC economy. The Oman economy is growing strongly over the recent decades with oil revenue as a heart of their revenue. The real GDP has a high growth rate since 1980. From 2000 to 2009, the real GDP has grown around 5.5%. The oil revenue is increasing at outer space in Oman. The Oman economy, even though there is a decline in the oil price in the world market, but still Oman economy could manage with the high production. So Oman economy is a non-OPEC country where they have their own monopoly in fixing up their production and also fixing up their price, where Ministry of Oil and Gas is taking care of fixing up the prices and the production level. Oman economy's crude oil output has increased to 7%. As far as depending on natural hydrocarbon-based industry is always a big problem for any country. So economic diversification is one of the major aim on all the five-year development plans. Outfacing this, the five-year plans, the seventh five-year plan, we are currently on the last year of our seventh five-year plan. The country really aimed to push up the economic diversification as one of the major aim way we want to develop tourism industry, fisheries, and agricultural sector. So where comes the role of small and medium scale enterprises? And here, Oman Development Bank is one of the pioneer development bank in the country, where it provides different types of loans, especially small and medium scale loans. When you see like the history, the origin of Oman Development Bank, it started in 1976 under the royal decree of 3176. Oman Development Bank is the first specialized development bank in contributing Sultanate's economic and social development. And during the three decades of banking activities, Oman Development Bank has pioneered the history of small-scale industries development in the Sultanate. As far as the definitions is concerned, defining SMEs is a very heterogeneous task. Each country has their own definitions. As far as Sultanate is concerned, the small and medium-scale enterprises is defined as from the employment level, where one to 50 employees, where any sector where they engaged 1 to 50 employees, they are called as small enterprises. And from 10 to 90 is this medium scale enterprises. And the importance of the small scale and medium industries is ultimate for labor observation, absorption, income distribution, and rural development and poverty eradication, and to have a balanced economic growth. SMEs, on the other hand, it creates employment also. If you see like Oman is in commodity-based market, where the SMEs can produce domestic goods and services which can easily substitute income importing the goods and services. And also it generates low income for the low-income groups, and also supporting for large-scale industries. The objective of my study is to analyze the effectiveness of ODB in financing small and medium-scale enterprises in sector-wise, and to study the approved SME loans in regional-wise. And the study period is from 2007 till 2009. The data to study the SME loan dispersed and the effectiveness in sector-wise distribution, linear and compound model are used in the analysis. The following are the different sectors where ODB dispersed the loans. And here is the mean and standard deviation. See the fishery sector, which is quoted in red, sees the highest mean, and the chemicals, which is quoted in blue, is the lowest mean. Due to the time constraint, I cannot go further in detail about analyzing the technical part of the analysis, but still I can glimpse it. See, using the linear model, tourism and wood sector, as far as concern, they show they demonstrated 5% significance. As far as Sultanate of Oman is a hard-coring upcoming area for tourism, so probably because of that. And this is the linear model. And this table shows the compound model. Compound model is used to, here again, tourism and food industries are showing 5% significance. The compound model is used to predict the year-wise growth rate, and the linear model is used to find the annual increments. Food sector, tourism, again, booming food sector, where majority, 25% of the labor is immigrants, immigrant laborers. So that, again, fetches more and more people incoming Oman, which raises the food industry. And here are the tables which shows the regional-wise allotment of number of loans in the Sultanate. And the regions, these are the various regions in our country. And the highest is the country aims for a balanced regional development. Keeping that in mind, the development plans activate like. So here, which is depicted in red, shows the highest and lowest, and Albatna, which shows 33%, which is the lowest. And followingly, like 2008, the same thing. If you see that, the loan dispersed will be on different regions, which really encourage the small and medium scale industries throughout Sultanate. And this again for 2007, 8, and 9. And each coin has a two side, hoping that the non-performing loans was very high. And keeping that in mind, the banking policies were very strict now. And this table shows that year-wise decline in the non-performing loans. And as to conclude, the small and medium scale industries create employment opportunities, and it reduces the regional disparities, and probably it helps for the future industrial expansion. And we hope we are celebrating our 40th year of renaissance, and hopefully under the patronage leadership of His Highness Sultan Qaboos, hopefully we will be one of the grooming and growing country in the Middle East. Thank you.
Thank you, Himba, for this interesting presentation. And the final presentation will be done by Mohammed, and it is cost minimization through interest rate microcredit to entrepreneurs, a case of Bangladesh. Mohammed.
Which place to? It's not there. It's not coming here. The previous one.
Would it be a PowerPoint presentation?
WSD. I'm not getting it here. Questions, presenters, and the participants, and the presenters of the oncoming sessions. Good morning to all of you. This is the topic that one of my colleagues in this session already discussed, touched about this, slumming banking. So this is also the same, the topics I'm discussing that contains Islamic banking principles, interest-free banking. This is relating to the micro side. I think you are well known about the microcredit Grameen Bank in Bangladesh,
Dr. Yunus, the Nobel Prize winner. He's one of my teachers at the university. While I was a student, he was teaching. And the concept of his microcredit and the concept of the Islamic banking microcredit is almost similar in a way, but this one completely operates without interest. How to, can you expand it, please? Can you please help me? Thank you so much. The cost minimization through interest-free microcredit to micro entrepreneurs, that micro, especially this small type of business we are talking about. Now, to study this one, that my studies, I did it in actually in Sweden. The field of my operation was in Turkey, in Cyprus, Sudan, Bangladesh, India, some parts of Pakistan. In all those places I collected data, but specifically I have taken here the one of the Bangladesh. Concepts of interest-free microcredit, and this is the things we shall be discussing. Interest-free bank and its modes of investments, concepts of different networks, theoretical approach, methodology and data collection, concepts of different costs, lending policies used for interest-free microcredit and end resource. So the microcredit conceptions, if we think of it, that lending small credit to rural-based small entrepreneurs on profit-sharing basis rather than interest basis. My colleague was giving descriptions about this. Normally, the entire burden of the project, the borrowed fund, is on borrowers. But in some modes of Islamic banking finance, it is not like that. In case of interest-free microcredit, as I observed in Sudan, they on Mosharaka system, that partnership system. In that system, that they share the risk, they both together. It is productive family projects in Khartoum, Omdurman. I had the visit there, and I interviewed microcredit people. There I have seen that how this Mosharaka partnership base of Islamic financing working there. This is another type of supervisory loan. After giving the loan, the bank does not separate themselves from the operating activities of the customers. They take care and they give proper attention so that the end results of the borrowed funds becomes profitable. And the loan, another thing most important side, the loan is not given in cash. Because in developing nations, that micro people, they are very reluctant, that means confused in handling the cash. As we know, the money is dangerous than snakes. If one cannot handle money properly, then it becomes, it bites them rather than it gives them benefit. So when the poor people get money, they have a lot of, lots of needs. So when they get money and then the problem comes that they don't know how to manage the finance. So in that case, Islamic bank in micro people, they never give cash. This is one difference between Dr. Yunus' study and ours. In case of Dr. Yunus, that microcredit given to women, they gave them loan in cash. But when it comes to the question of Islamic bank, they don't give cash, they give in kind. What do you need? You need material to produce something. That's okay, we shall supply you the materials. So when they get the materials, and then they can start the production. Otherwise, when you give the money, then they start spending the money, the dowry for the children, the daughter's marriage, others' functions, and this and that. So in this way, they just misuse the funds. Then we have come to when I was discussing all these things, I took this institutional network approach. There I have come across different types of networks that I developed in my theory, personal network, industrial network, symbolic network, social network, inter or intra-organizational network, and external or the inter-organizational network. All these things I studied because I wanted to see the how these micro-credit people that can develop different kinds of networks when they are doing their financing activities with Islamic banks. Then this, the theoretical approach is taken in a way that the different types of similar organizations I have taken into one group and have given the institutionalized this group that given I have given them a form of an institution. Suppose grassroots level and the all similar types of organizations I took together, and then we come this medium that is called semi-mechanized and called seasonal microcredit. So all those types of similar types of I've taken together and then I discuss is from this institutional model. Then I have seen some other things when working on that, that there are certain societal sector institutions impact on this credit system, this financing system, country culture, political system, legal system, government, family, clan, and religion. These are called these economic actors that they work between the financial organizations and the between lenders and borrowers. How culture affects, how political system affects, how religion affects, how legal system, government, and family clan direct impact on these lending and borrowing functions. And after that, this is the theory that developed to do my research, that this internal network of small entrepreneurs system and internal network of a major financing system. In this system, I have taken conventional banks, Islamic banks, money lenders, all those, and their financing systems. And then the external financial exchange network. Then develop this, how these other exchange networks work there. Then this is organizational fields, and then I'm coming with the societal sectors, which I already showed you, then country, culture, religion, family, clan, and then comes government, political systems, and legal system. Based on this theoretical model, I did my study that how that microcredit is given by Islamic Bank and how these people use that credit. Then I have come to the analyze in my writings the different concepts of the cost, information cost. Bank, before giving the loan, they take the information and how it is a costly matter, but bank motivate this information techniques in such a way that it reduces cost. Distance cost. The Islamic Bank, they work as a bank to the poor. So poor people, they do not go to the bank, rather bank comes to them. And contract cost. When they make the contract with other conventional banks, especially in our country, it is highly costly. And then, but in Islamic Bank, they make it simple. Legal cost. Legal cost normally comes if bank give loans and if default case comes and then they cannot realize the money, they have to go to the court. They have to take the actions. But in this case, as it is a supervisory loan, all the time bank is giving a constant supervision, so the loan repayment rate is very high. And that's why the legal cost also they save. Then from borrowers' perspectives, information from what they are getting information. These poor people, they don't know the bank. So who are giving them information? This is all information. Marketing and selling cost, distance cost, for them same also. Cost of processing materials and goods, procuring, just procuring to process and procure, and loan processing cost. Then I have come to discuss the steps that various modes of financing. As you see, that capital financing called Mudaraba. In this case, it is the bank who will finance and the borrower, they'll give their time and expertise. If a doctor, then they start a clinic. It is the bank who will supply every equipment of the clinic. Doctor will sit and they give their time and look after the patients and earn money, and at a certain period of time, they will share it. So if there is any the loss, it will be borne by the bank, not by the expertise, the professional people. Second one, partnership financing, musharaka. That means they according to the agreement, they supply capital and they share whatever they get, and they supervise and manage is the equally. Then markup, that is cost plus profit. That is mostly in, especially Dubai and other countries they are following, but that is not the pure system in, so to say, the Islamic way of financing. That is, they will buy for you something and they will add profit on that, and then they will sell to you. This is called this cost plus profit. Advanced purchase, sometimes there are the product in the field, not yet the ready. Then at that time, the bank comes and they pay to them, and then when the crops are ready, then they sell it. And the hard purchase is almost the hard purchase system which we are working with in Western world. And then leasing system, it is also almost same, but a bit different what they twist the interest case. But in my case, what I have taken, the cost plus profit sales under default payment. That means they give the money to buy materials, and they add some profit on that. And the entire amount they take as a loan, and in an installment basis, default installment basis, the micro entrepreneurs, they start paying. Now, the system, this research method that which I used when I did my field work, it is just how I collected, interviewed the people, collected data from them. This is a simple the description of that one, that different micro entrepreneurs taken as a group, and then the system I use, sometimes tape recorder, sometimes just discussions, sometimes the question, sometimes without question, and according to situation what I did. Then this is the important portion of the discussion, lending procedures, how Islamic Bank lends to micro entrepreneurs. That is the initiation of groups and team among customers. When they start, they explore some area to give loan, they ask these micro entrepreneurs to make some group. So they make 3 or 4 persons a group. And then after that, there is the group, there is a group leader, and the 5 group leaders, they make a team leader. There is a chain of network starts. And a team leader, the head of the team leader, they communicate to the bank. And then opening of accounts with banks, after that, they encourage all the customers and the members in the group to open accounts in the bank. Collection of weekly deposits by bank officers. They encourage them to collect weekly deposits, a minimum deposit, the local currency, 20, 30, 40, whatever amount. It is just to make them saving-minded. So the group leaders collect the deposits, give to team leaders give to the bank officer. Bank officer regularly come and visit them. In the meantime, encourage them, talk to them, ask them about their projects. About 10 weeks, this process continues. And in the meantime, the bank and the customers, they get to know each other very well. And then the actual function starts. Bank officers, direct contact and advice. Various, the different projects, bank officers, they discuss the possibilities, and then how they expertise, what they know, and how they will be operating, all these things they keep on discussing. Project proposals after saving period ends, 10 weeks ends, then everybody makes a project proposals with the amount of money they need. Payment of loan amount, then banks start now paying loan. This payment of loan is not like that they are given directly cash. And they are given the loan that what you want, this, I want to buy chicks, I want to buy some grains, or I want to buy some seeds. Bank directly contact to the supplier and give money to them and tell supplier you bring the seeds to their home. And they start now their production. Direct supervision of borrowed funds. Whatever funds they give, and they keep on supervising at a regular basis. Then repayment of loan. When the production finish, they start selling. And then from that time, they give a gap time, and then they start now realizing the loan. So the loan is loan plus profit. A percentage of profit is at there. That total amount they make in installments, and they start realizing. So this is the process, actually. In this process, now we can see that how the bank is communicating with customers, customer with communicating. And this process develop the network. This process give a close contact with the bank. It is very tough to see a bank officer, a poor man in our country like Bangladesh. But when bank officer comes directly to the poor people in the village, start talking to them, they're encouraged and motivated and they want to do something. And then when they are given advice and they become more morally conscious and they start working effectively. And with this, that we can see the I want to have the end result. Although I have got figures and facts, it is in my the detail the article for time consumption, for the time limitation. I have taken the results. Close supervision, so supervisor credit, reduced distance cost. That means the way infrastructure in our country to go from one place to another, it is very tough. Just an example. I went from Oman to Bangladesh 4 hours by plane. From the airport to my home, it takes 15 to 20 minutes to go. It is unthinkable. It took more than 4 hours for me to go from the airport to home. This is just a simple example. It happens because of the rush and then because of a lot of problems, strikes, lockouts. It always with us. So in this case, a poor person to go to bank just to contact and for to process loan, very big hassles. Now this is when the bank comes directly, then the distance cost, it gets reduced actually for the lenders, borrowers. Unique personal networking reduce marketing cost. When bank give loan to different groups, they start advertising, they start promoting the product of one group to others, and they create a networking. The way today we are told that conference is meant for not to give lectures, create network. Later on, you contact with each other. It will develop your faculty. Exactly the same thing what happens, I saw in Sudan, Turkey, Cyprus, and Bangladesh. Bank introduced the products of one company. In Sudan, I have seen a very big room they have, showroom. Very many products are theirs. I asked, what is this? Every customer, when come, they show. This is the products of different customers they are producing, and they are given loan on Musharaka basis. So they are cheap and more attractive, and the outsiders, they give order. And then in this way, bank promotes their business. So this marketing cost now reduced by that. Smooth loan recovery rate reduced legal cost. That's for bank side. That is when bank keep in touch with bank, the customers, encourage them, help them, and then advise them to do good work, and then poor people, they're effective and efficient, but they don't have someone to advise them. When they get it, and the good result, and that bank does not need to go to the court to realize the money, to take their land property, or all these things, so legal cost is reduced like that. Simple lending formalities, it's very simple. They don't need to fill a lot of forms, a lot of formalities, just simple form for simple people. So it also, borrowing cost, borrowers does not need to give a lot of money. In conventional bank, a lot of money you have to give initial deposit. The 10 local currency is enough, initial deposit for a microcredit, the entrepreneurs. Then banks' direct interference in procuring raw materials reduce the raw material procuring cost. Suppose to bring raw material from supplier's house or suppliers to come to supply it, all these things takes a lot of cost. But now the bank direct them and tell them to bring the product to their house, and that reduces the cost also. Group loan giving system reduce administrative cost. That means the way I have shown you, saying group leader, team leader, and they go to the bank. So this chain of command automatically brings them closer, and then administrative cost reduce. They work together jointly. Lender borrowers mutual cooperations eliminates hidden cost. Hidden cost, this is a cost which is hidden. It is called bribe or just money, illegal money. That means whatever you want to do, then you must give some bribe or something. Otherwise, the file does not move. And this is what happens in developing countries. So when bank directly involved, then third person, especially those middlemen, they come and they process the loan. They take a lot of money. In one case, I have one, 20,000 he is borrowing, about 5,000 gone. Thank you. So the bank's initiatives in promoting customers' business reduce advertising cost. inter and intra-organizational network reduce uncertainty cost. That means network reduces the cost of uncertainty. That saves micro-entrepreneurs from the burden of heavy interest cost of local moneylenders. The local moneylenders, they take a lot of the interest when they give loan, and Islamic bank introduction reduces that cost. So this is a conclusion for my result, which I found. I thank you very much for listening. You are most welcome if you want to ask any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mohammed. Ladies and gentlemen, you have listened to four diverse presentations, and I'm sure there are a number of questions in your minds about those presentations as we ponder what has happened in the world over the last couple of years with the international financial crisis, as we in St. Lucia consider our situation and how we can find systems to finance sustainable development. The issue of the role of governments in banking and lending, the issue of the role of development banks, a culture, models for financing SMEs. Of course, SMEs, as we know, are basically the drivers of many economies all over the world. We're told, for instance, in St. Lucia that 75% of the firms in St. Lucia would be classified as SMEs. How do we take those presentations, adapt them, so we can do a number of things in our respective jurisdictions? So the floor is open for some questions. I'll suggest that you come to the platform so that at least there's a mic down there. Is there a mic down there? Yeah, thanks. Okay, can we just pass the mic around? Question one over there. No, sorry, over there. Then number two, number three, number four.
My question is for Mr. Mohammed. Two questions, really. What are the minimum requirements for actually selecting the entrepreneurs? What must they have at a minimum for actually qualifying for such a loan? Because from your explanation, the bank does most of the accounting and financing on behalf of that business. And my second question, what happens after the loan has been repaid? Does the bank continue to maintain a relationship with these?
Thank you. I come from the second one. The micro entrepreneurs, when they start certain business, that means it is not that they end the project and business is end. So it is a continuous process. And the government gives them loan. And then even those entrepreneurs, they, besides the existing one, they are encouraged to open some other projects also. So it is a continuous process. It doesn't end there. They encourage them. So they want to bring the entire set of the loan. They do not encourage them to go to other bank or conventional banks. Just they themselves, they help them, and they make situation such that they always be with the Islamic bank. Micro entrepreneurs, that if you that you are asking that the is it actually asking for definitions? What is what the how it is to be defined? Yeah, exactly. Now suppose that it is like that. Look at our country, that the country here in St. Lucia, this people in the rural village. So someone wants to just to buy some chicks, the chicken to produce, okay, poultry type of the dairy farm, poultry farm. So they have got the capabilities, they have got the experience, expertise, but they don't have the money. So the before giving loan, that the bank, the interview them, talk to them, and then when bank is satisfied that really they want to work hard, and the environment allow them to do something, but they don't have the money, at that time bank proceeds and bank start helping them. Okay? I hope I answered the question. Thank you.
Okay. My question is to Dr. Alam also. I have two concerns with your model. The first being whether or not it is collateral free, and whether or not in the group lending, whether each member of the group are required to borrow the same amount, or you borrow the differences.
No, thank you.
Different amount.
I come from the second one. You see, the group is not that. This group, as I told you, the group, they request to make a group just for developing a network and to make one another known to each other, and also that the bank can work smoothly. This group, five members in a group, they're not from the five same business. They're from different business. One is dairy, one is poultry, one is just handmade things. So in this way, so the loan differ from person to person. Okay, that is number one. And number two, the collateral, come to collateral. They take collateral, that is minimum. In fact, it is not that serious issue there. Because when there is a direct involvement by the bank, when there is, suppose now they are not giving the money, they are not giving cash, they are giving the raw materials. So at that time, the collateral comes, but it is not as like as other conventional banks.
Third question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think my comment and question has to go to Buck. In his presentation, what a wonderful presentation that was in the context of the global financial crisis. But what I'm interested in is, we are aware that this financial crisis was really triggered by the mortgage lenders and the important role of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, etc. But I'm coming to a point. We're looking at the United States of America, well, having the largest world economy, having all the resources, you know, started developing from 1620 onwards, becoming the top number one military power in the world. That's the only world power we have now. Yet still, they seem to have the biggest foreign debt. All right, as you explained, the debt to GDP is about 100%. Now, I find that very interesting, but yet still, on the other hand, if you look at China, with all its resources and taking over the world market in terms of production, and having all that amount of foreign currency, that is US dollars, holding a lot of that, they seem to have all the power. And from some discussions and some debates that we have been hearing around, as if this may be a precursor, or China is approaching that point where they will become, or their currency will be the main one. But you made a very, very interesting point. That is trust. It would appear as if
Could we come to the question, please, so we can, can take more?
All right. Thank you. But what I'm asking, I have several more questions, you know, Mr. Chairman. I do not know, but all the other presenters have questions for. But let me just come to the question now. Do you think, now you seem to be very convinced that the US dollar will remain the number one world currency? But looking at the US currency vis-a-vis the euro dollar, and bear in mind that even the UK pound, the UK pound in my view is reasonably sound and reasonably stable. Don't you think as time go on, there may be an overtaking of the US currency?
Okay, thanks for the question for you.
Is that
for you.
Thank you very much for your question. Yes, it's interesting, you know, people who do future projections say that by 2022 or maybe 2025, the dollar will become the second most important currency, because by that time, China would have developed into a major economic and financial force. Chinese economy is catching up very rapidly. It has already surpassed Germany. It has also surpassed Japan, and it's now the second biggest one. But there's a huge problem with the renminbi, because the renminbi is not even freely exchangeable. And if you look at the five determinants that make a currency a key currency, China only fulfills two of the three. So China's got some homework to do, and the major one is to create financial markets. You can't really be a key currency if you don't have major, deep, wide, resilient financial markets. In that sense, China is very immature. They're working hard on it. Shanghai is fast becoming one of the financial hubs in the East. But what China's got to do is to become a more open economy, to get more political power, because if you've got to be a key currency, you must have financial, diplomatic, military, and political power. So China has got the economic power already, but it lacks the diplomatic and the political and the financial power. But it's fast working on that, and China is a country that says 20 years is only one small bit of time. They're working with hundreds and 200s of years. They're a very old civilization, so they're willing to wait 100 more years. But slowly but surely, they are working in that direction. Currently, they've got $1.3 trillion that they hold in dollar assets. And the reason for that is that by that, they depreciate their own currency so that they can ship out more export goods to the United States. And then they also hold the money with which the United States buy the goods. So they give the United States $1.3 trillion of assets, and then they lend the United States the money to buy the export goods from China. So in that way, China is run and actually is under the control of the United States. If the United States stops buying exports from China, the Chinese economy is gone. So China is too much dependent on the United States to run the economy in the way they do. So right now on the horizon, there's no other currency. As I've said, the euro is not going to make it. I would say if there's ever a replacement currency for the dollar, the Asian countries should stand together and they should form one single regional currency. If Japan and Korea and China and a couple of other countries band together and they develop their own regional country, that will stand up to the dollar. But they don't have that coherence or forming that kind of alliance.
If I just may add onto your answer as well, given the size of China's holding of U.S. currency, they also have an interest in ensuring that the U.S. currency stays up, because if it is destabilized, they'll also lose value in their holding as well. So they are also in a very difficult situation. Let us take one other question. I'll come back to you if I have more time. Okay?
All right.
Yeah, thanks. Ah, okay. All right. So go ahead. And then I come to you.
Thanks. Mr. Chairman, I promise I will not ask all the questions. Just one more. It has to do with Islamic banking. Mm. In Islamic banking, there's no interest. As far as we understand it, there are other charges. But I fear that there is a cost to the borrowing of money, time value of money. There is a natural cost. A dollar today is worth less tomorrow. So therefore, there has to be a means of having this to be sustainable. My question to you isn't those charges that has been made reference to not is the same as the interest as we know it in the Western world?
Yes. Now, the things which many people say like that, actually, that it is another way of charging interest. But the basic thing is that it is not true. In a way, it is not like that. Because, look, all interest-based bank, they are working on cash basis. That's the main difference here now. So the main principle of the Islamic banking financing is based on kind rather than cash. So that system, when introduced, at that time, the things become different. It is not that they are not benefiting, they are not taking benefit, they are taking. But now the involvement of Islamic bank with borrowers' activities is much more heavier than the conventional banks. And another thing is most important, that if you practically go and see that Islamic banking activities in Malaysia, in Indonesia, in Bangladesh, some other countries, so you will see that you will find that how they are seriously involved in with borrowers, the benefit and advantage. They just don't give money and then keep themselves aloof or silent. So, and then before they take project, as my colleague was telling, that they do not invest in such projects that they are not sustainable or they are not actually contributing much in the society. So there are a lot of the resource takes place before they give money. And then they take some benefit. Without benefit, a bank cannot survive. But that is not the benefit that conventional bank taking as they take. And then that is not the loan they are giving the way the conventional bank gives. These are the differences makes this the Islamic banking and conventional bank differences.
You know, if I could just add something, I didn't know anything about Islamic banking before we started to take a look at this. It seems to me if somebody is going to use your money, you're going to want something in return for that. Now, whether you call that an interest payment or a piece of the profit, you still get something in return. It seems to me, and I understand there's a philosophical difference, culturally primarily, but it seems to me you're still taking something in return for your money, and it's really semantics, whether you call it an interest payment or a piece of the profit. And frankly, I think, as my colleague said, the percent of the profit is likely to cost the borrower more than paying interest. If I want to borrow $100 to make something that I can sell for $150, I go to the bank. Bank says, I'll lend you $100 for 6 months. I'm going to charge you $5 for that. In the system where you buy the raw material, I believe it's human nature to say, I'm going to buy this for $100. This guy's going to sell it for $150. I should get $20 out of that. So I have a feeling that the borrower ends up paying more under that system than under a system where you know what the interest charges are. One last comment. Mohammed's model, I think, works very well if you're looking at relatively small loans where the banker has more knowledge than the borrower. Once you get to the point where the borrower is a little more sophisticated about his business, I don't believe that system is going to work, because the borrower will then be more knowledgeable about the business than the banker will. And I've been in situations personally where the banks require me to do something on a project, and it's just counter to the success of the project. It does protect the bank's position, but it is counter to the success of the project.
Just let me ask quickly, but given your explanation, by Western standards, would you regard this as debt financing or equity financing? Because if you have a stake in the profit, you're not actually providing a debt, you're providing some equity.
I don't know what the answer to that is. I'd be interested. Would you view that as a debt or equity financing? Equity? I'll tell the court in Louisiana.
Okay, let's take a question, McLaren.
My question is to Michael. I think you made a point in your presentation that you pointed to what brought about the financial crisis was more or less government interference.
It's my view, yes.
Yeah, however, the evidence seems to suggest that it was a lack thereof, a lack of government interference. There was the market had a free hand and so on. And that is why when on the campaign by Obama, a number of statements were made, and afterwards you had a number of regulations and institutions being put in place to properly regulate the sector. So I want you to at least deal with these two matters, because yeah, you made the point that it was a government interference, and the evidence suggested otherwise. A hands-off approach by government and lack of regulation, proper regulation. And the second question is to Bok. I hope I have your name.
Can
right.
I answer the first one before I forget what you said?
you want to talk? All right.
I believe the finance industry does need some broad regulations. There are some in place, and maybe they need some modification. Again, what happened was, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac took all of these mortgages, went to Lehman Brothers, and I spoke with some executives at Lehman Brothers. They said to Lehman Brothers, package these into mortgage-backed securities and sell them on the open market. The Lehman Brothers executive said the default rates on these mortgages are going to be significantly higher than what we've seen in the past, and as a result, we need to modify the offerings to the market. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, having government backing, said, assume the default rates will be the same in this than they would be traditionally. The executives of Lehman Brothers said that's not going to be the case. The government instructed them to sell it like that. So much were the Lehman Brothers executives not in favor of this. Many of the executives shorted those products, which, as you know, you end up making money when it goes down in value. Now, they're being investigated for that. However, I think they made some rational decisions. The government said, assume the default rates are constant. They said, if you do that, you'll sell them at a good price. When the default rates are as high as we think they're going to be, they're going to drop down in value significantly. Lehman Brothers executives shorted those and ended up making a lot of money because that's exactly what happened. So again, I would argue it was the government intervention that really brought that on.
You seem to be more or less focusing on China. Maybe if China, they have a very strong economy, they may be able to overtake the dollar. However, let me just put to you, don't you think that if the UK joins the euro currency, you know, the sterling is already strong, stronger than the dollar, the euro is stronger than the dollar, and the UK has a very well-organized financial market. If the UK joins the EU, I mean, not the EU, but the euro currency, don't you think it would then become a threat, or greater threat, to the US dollar?
Okay.
I think the answer to your question lies in the if they join. I don't think they will join. On so many occasions, they've indicated that they don't want to join. And Margaret Thatcher has said that the European Union and the euro stand to disintegrate within the next 15 or 20 years. Now, that was already more than 10 years ago. So the British people are not very much inclined to join. But let's work with the if. Let's say, okay, maybe they want to join. Maybe politically they will join. Yes, and you are quite correct, because if you add the British, especially the London financial market, the treasury market, money market, capital market, as well as the share market, then they will for sure fulfill one of the three. Then they will help the euro to fulfill three of the five determinants of a key currency. But the major problem with the European Union is that there's no commander-in-chief politically. It's a fragmented society with different autonomous states, and overhead there's a British Parliament, but that hasn't got any influence. Strong currencies have got strong political backing. The euro hasn't got political backing. It's a currency without a country. It's a currency without a country. There's no superior commander-in-chief politically. And that means that whenever a crisis hit them, they've got to come together. It takes very long to get decisions and to get to a point where they can actually apply policy. So that's the major problem with the euro. And even if Britain, the UK, if they join, they still suffer from that political fragmented society where there is no political government that can take fast decisions. And on a diplomatic and military and political front, you've got to have a commander-in-chief that say, okay, let's do this, let's do it quickly, and you don't have time to tarry along. So that's the major shortcoming, and they recognize that. Otmar Issing, one of the major thinkers, one of the major brains behind the European Union, said at the very beginning, we are going to be a currency without a country. And that's a problem. It's a fragmented artificial union of countries, but they haven't got one single homogeneous political entity.
Okay, I'm sure the discussions will continue over lunch, but as chairman, I will exercise some privilege and ask one question, and I won't let him escape without answering the question. In St. Lucia and, of course, the Eastern Caribbean, there's a debate as to the relevance of development banks. In fact, we in St. Lucia have had the experience of having had one before, merging a commercial bank and establish a new one. How would you respond to this issue in terms of the role of development banks in financing SMEs? Is it still relevant given the new financial architecture that has evolved in the world?
As far as development bank is concerned, they are under the direct control of the government. and commercial banks or with CBOs, Central Bank of Oman.
Sorry?
Central Bank of Oman.
Sorry, I didn't get that.
I didn't understand, yeah.
No, is there a role for development banks in financing SMEs as opposed to commercial banks? Because they're now saying allow commercial banks to do all those things. There's no need
for... commercial banks too provide loans for SMEs.
Okay.
But ODB is fully franchised for this.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we've come to the end of this session, and I believe you are to proceed. There's one more question? Okay, I will allow that privilege.
Thank you, much appreciated. Mm. This is a question for Mr. Busler, is it?
Busler, yeah.
Okay. In relation to what you're just saying in terms of the housing crisis in the U.S., given that the theme of this conference is sustainable development, do you think that the approach in terms of Lehman Brothers choosing to short the sales, the executives, and choosing to make profits for themselves, as opposed to raising the objections that they had and going nationally and trying to protect the homeowners, do you think that that is sustainable?
No.
Okay, so.
That's the short answer. Lehman Brothers, I don't believe, would have been in that position had the government not instructed them to market those securities a certain way. With regard to development, I believe in the early stages of development, there is a role for government to play to jumpstart the process. I believe once the process is jump-started and the government backs out and lets the marketplace take over, I believe everybody will be better served. Now, I understand, again, getting started is difficult, and there is a role for government, but I would, in my view, would be to limit that role and to try to get out as soon as possible.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me... thank the presenters for four very interesting presentations, and to ask you to join me, give them a round of applause, please.